The Obligations by Kate Shapira. To start from the house of choice, you must keep your hands to yourself, palms up and creased. You must keep how eagerly you incur debt, the mustiness of must, the straight lace. You must make good on your present offers first, embracing, flinging yourself down on them like a wet mattress left out in the field. Your imprint must not be enough. Tulips feather out in the sun and stamens darken above shawls of leaves while the person in the bed, is he shivering, scratching? Is the TV on, the window open, the tissue rigid? Has she been in this morning? What of her contract? I unlock the neighbor's door as promised, his contraction, books on survival roof, the bedside table. Pulley the blind, as promised, leverage the window, the gap in their coverage, nudge the jug to the roof edge, cantilever out, cool tops of mint and basil, but no one could live up here, the sun is coming to drive out this water. In the secret brief and moving part, known for raunch and danger, I seed a future of care where I am obliged and must seize. I walked right into it. Children, whose house is this? The sunshine waxed, sieved like a young open glance. You must come to light. Your immediate ancestors are renovating the bathroom. One of them needs 3 new teeth and a new phone. You must listen to the negotiations. One of them holds in an organ pocket. All the other has told her. To care for her, you must distribute this, but you mustn't stop there. You must not stop at all. The woman squatting down as if compelled, in debt as pavilion, heavy pack, dry crossing, has been married for years to the person in the bed whose liver has been replaced, a whole meat liver alive. Forgive me if I'm startled by this. The woman listening is my mother. She's how I know this story, and come to think of it, of him as the person in the bed, although he may not be palmed down anymore. Cramp, cut-off point, potted plant, recovery. The sunset makes nothing. Eyeing, you must look away. You must cut your side open. Must ferment. There's no one here. Orange slabs of light fill before they're stopped. The mandate lodged. Do you have anyone waiting? You must. Naive on your license, your red heart, your liver can be called upon. The craving the body knows, and the craving the story knows. The craving it's deaf to until one day, until suddenly. You're not the same all the time, so you must add to the time. All instantly response and flinch and weave. You must not understand the cell ballet. Think of the week now. You must think about them so much. The rigor bells ringing iron, clapper and tongue, can't be edited or lit. Where are we in the Mercator projection like dividing cells of seas? Floating in debt to peel grinning from the branches of this world. I want to learn the best, irreducible care of this world. I invite. The chunk of asphalt I've been feeling behind my face is in this world, as if pleasure were failed garbage and attention to be paid. I balk at inviting, stand on the trading ground, feeling the nightline stretch out.
L'esprit nouveau et les poètes, de Guillaume Apollinaire. Traduit du français par Richard Costellanets.
The New Spirit and the Poets, by Guillaume Apollinaire. Translated from the French by Richard Costellanets.
L'esprit nouveau qui dominera le monde entier.
The new spirit that will dominate world poetry has emerged in French poetry as nowhere else. The strong intellectual discipline, so customarily French, allows certain French poets, as well as their spiritual allies, to have a heightened sense of arts and letters, all without echoing antiquity or the currently prevailing sentiments for romantic beauty. The new spirit soon to dominate world poetry has emerged in France as in poetry nowhere else. The strong intellectual discipline indigenously French has allowed certain French poets, as well as their literary allies, to have a heightened sense of arts and letters, all without echoing antiquity or recent ideals of romantic beauty.
L'esprit nouveau qui s'annonce prétend avant
this new spirit claims primarily to inherit from the classics some sound common sense, critical thinking, a universe perspective, the human soul, and a sense of duty that reveals our feelings and limits, or rather contains their examples.
Les sentiments et en limite, ou plutôt en contient les manifestations. Il prétend encore hériter
it still claims to inherit romantic curiosity that drives him to explore all the areas likely to provide a literary material that allows to exalt life in whatever form it presents itself. From romantic curiosity comes the drive to explore anything likely to provide literary inspiration and therefore to exalt life in unfamiliar ways.
Explorer la vérité.
To explore the truth, seeking more in the ethnic domain than in the imagination, become the main characters of this new spirit. This trend remains, has always had its bold representatives who did not know, and there has long it is formed, it is running. This persisting trend has always had its bold advocates who, though previously unaware of it, discovered that it was long developing.
Cependant, c'est la première fois
However,
qu'elle se présente
this is the first time she has conscience itself, in that, until now, the literary field was confined within narrow limits.
On écrivait
they wrote in prose or verse you wrote,
en vers.
Regarding the prose, grammatical rules, staring, form. However, not until now has this new spirit become fully conscious of itself. Until now, the literary world was stuck within narrow limits where an author wrote in prose or verse. Especially in the writing of prose, grammatical rules ruled.
Pour ce qui est de la poésie, la
in terms of poetry, rhymed verse was the only law which suffered periodic attacks, but nothing was beginning. Within the world of poetry, only rhymed verse suffered periodic attacks, though it was never vulnerable.
Le vers libre donna un libre essor
free verse gave free rein to lyricism, but it was only one step. Explorations could be done in the field of the form. While free verse liberated lyricism, this was only one direction toward exploring new possibilities of form.
Les recherches dans la forme
research in the form have now taken a great importance. It is legitimate.
Elle est légitime.
Poetic investigations into alternatives have become more important and legitimate.
Comment cette recherche n'intéresse-t-elle
How this
pas
research
le poète?
It not interest the poet?
Elle qui peut déterminer
she can determine new discoveries in thought and lyricism.
Et dans le lyrisme.
How can such investigations not interest poets predisposed to new discoveries in thought and lyrical expression?
Chemiczne reakcje by Grzegorz Wróblewski. Translated from the Polish by Piotr Gwiazda. Chemical reactions. Waterproof shoe spray. First, it helped us get rid of spiders. The little monsters fell from the window, coiled and disoriented. Meanwhile, I, their temporary master, cried with joy. Minimalism by Grzegorz Wróblewski. Translated from the Polish by Piotr Gwiazda. Minimalism. Amidst the sorrow of war, she found the road to hope. In theaters, Friday. Kempingowicze by Grzegorz Wróblewski. Translated from the Polish by Piotr Gwiazda. Campers. Tell your child about the risks of substance abuse. Tell your child about the crimes of backroom financiers. Tell your child how marijuana impairs learning skills. Family life is a challenge. 12% of campers choose tents. Dolor by Grzegorz Wróblewski. Translated from the Polish by Piotr Gwiazda. Dolor. The sun leans to the west, the wind ceases at dusk. How is the dollar doing?
Booked bilinguality. Words like people. maybe used or users too. Your bigs, your smalls, your elephantines, and bisou. Subtle, subliminal, sublime. Take the larger-than-life locution, celebrity heaping stockpiles of reserve, star-like for an asterisk, the common man's preeminence, trailer parks of articles and prose. The ex-con back in precincts cuffed to prefix or conjunction, still our people, through and through. 1 to 180. The issue of your nth degree is unresolved in spinning one fell swoop 180, frontside snapped 180. The issue of your mth degree is unresolved in spinning one fell swoop 180, frontside snapped 180. Better the slow turn by six counts 30 apiece. Six haphazard lacunae. Nuanced breathly habitual, likewise towards impairment. Ever constricted. TH. Kazu Marzu man. The young man's over-the-table manners prove as difficult to gag or to muzzle as his under-the-table mannerisms are to properly yoke. Get a boy to eat with his lips sealed, where it promises him no convenience, and further, where neither his god nor the laws of your administration condemn him otherwise, if you should manage to feed new shape to even his rawest, most primal calibrations, you will see that the few small things which do escape his lips have already been digested.
Kill him off. 1. I stayed late at the Pine Ridge dormitories again last night. I've been sleeping with an AmeriCorps volunteer who works there named Sonia. She's from New Hampshire. She runs some of the extracurricular programming. She has this warm voice and she's kind. Volunteering on the Indian reservation completely overwhelms her. We ate dinner quietly in her tiny room so no one would notice I was there. We could hear the children screaming downstairs. On my way home that night, the reservation looked like it had been set in an aquarium tank. Everything was deep blue in the night, and the lights were soft and foggy in the frost. The sickle moon hung like the sword of Damocles over my car, and I was moving at speed, and I lost all sense of time. When I got back to my little room in the trailer where I live, I tried to read. I am reading a book by Roberto Bolaño. I keep losing track of the plot because I'm unable to see past the imagery. The night is a wall, and the trees are people, etc. There are discarded bodies of women, raped and buried in unmarked holes. I'm always distracted these days. It is difficult for me to complete a thought, even. Last night, I could hear Farah, our school librarian, talking through the wall of the trailer. All of us volunteers live together, and we get to know each other that way. I couldn't help but listen to her last night. I think she was talking to her boyfriend back in Seattle, where she comes from. I'm ashamed to say it, but I recorded her with my laptop. I don't know why I did it, but I have the recording saved in my iTunes. She says at one point, "I organize books, that's it. But they treat me like a welcome mat here. It's just Indians, you know? It's this whole place. Nothing like El Salvador. They're brats at this school. The parents too, probably. They have iPods here. Yeah, exactly. You get it. Yeah, but with actual roofs." Farah went to El Salvador on a church mission trip a few months before she came to the reservation. During our training session, when we arrived, it was all she talked about. She went on for a long time last night about how good people have it here, and how it was better in El Salvador because it was worse. She has this image of noble, long-suffering poor people with faces like the labels of fair trade coffee bags. I recorded Farah for almost an hour before she hung up. After that, I lay awake in the dark, listening to the wind blow through the crack beneath my window. This morning, I found Farah in the library, making a poster for her afternoon class. It was a map of El Salvador on a yellow piece of butcher paper, mounted on a strip of poster board. Above the map, she'd pasted a panoramic printed from the internet. It was a picture of a city skyline dusted with heavy red smog and cars and ragged buses. And if you looked closely, you could see the brown-skinned children squatting in the gutters like dogs. 2. At Manderson Day School, where I am a bus driver, they burn all of their trash in an open pit. They do it behind the playground next to the field where the football team practices. It happens everywhere on the reservation, in similar pits near similar playgrounds. It's legal to burn trash here because of tribal law, so all the nearby white counties give the Indian schools money to burn their garbage. Everyone benefits, you could say. They burn it at night now, at least in Manderson, because the parents complained about what the fumes might do to their children. In the early evenings, you can see the flames in the darkness. Today, I found another big wasp's nest under one of the wooden benches outside the school, and I sprayed it with the stuff they sell in cans for killing wasps. They came stumbling out of the hive, sick with the stuff, tangled up in it. I crushed each one of them under my boot so as not to prolong their agony. They say that these swarms of wasps are a plague, that they are a sign of the times. We've been killing them every day for weeks now. We've put a sizable dent in their population. Plan is that eventually there will be no more wasps left on the reservation. Yesterday, while I was driving the school bus through Wounded Knee housing, some boys on horses threw rocks at us as we passed. They have done this before, but this time they broke one of the windows. The children came alive like birds. Someone was hurt, this small boy, and all the blood, his own blood. It seemed to terrify him. Some of the other kids were crying, too, just because they were afraid. I wasn't sure what it meant. I'd suspected nothing that morning. We ate breakfast pizza in the school gymnasium while someone read the morning announcements over the intercom. The sagebrush and the tall grass stood as straight and unfeeling as they ever did. The ditches on either side of the road were as pathetic and trash-covered as ever. The sky was soaring cold. Everything that day was beyond my deserving. There was blood on the seat of the school bus and on the floor, and these boys on their horses outside, they were laughing because they didn't realize what they had done. I radioed dispatch for help. The woman on the other end said that she was on the line with 911. They wanted some specific information about the boys, so I pushed back through the writhing mass of children to look. It was getting dark outside, and through the window, the faint moon shone over the reservation like a vagrant woman. The boy had small pieces of glass embedded in his shoulder, and in the darkness for a moment, I thought it was a wing.
Theory of the proceeding. The south edge is a rift at the Lake Bluff exposures,
where tonight far locusts beat its grayish bands to sear and airy scars.
For formerly it is everywhere scarps, but tonight it is both.
And it is also gravel and wing drone. That is, it's a told sour grass, a hum, an offertory.
And this range, too, that we found where the Lake Michigan Bluff exposures are not clearly back formations of the oldest till of names,
but rather as blood high in oak and sycamore.
They are now defined as a minimum of two, or a rift,
or a ghosting twitch of an animal other in trailing pose.
For really, this range is a bluff exposure of the great, of the wax slow flow of years around Lake Michigan's basin.
Or it's how across from us the harbors are, in most places, sandier with hushed tokens of wealth, wound down and winnowed in rushed and tidal rows.
Or how the theory of the proceeding may be found in the most noteworthy characteristics of its making, as if of this evening, or rather its dun oil, fanning maritime skies.
Of which we may say it's a glacial description of this place.
As if it were a gravid old and planetary distance, plus its geological age.
Precisely where the draft and draw of wind-deaf sails at Lake Michigan Bluffs may act as an exposure of the latter day in summer lake spray of the here and now.
Where a difference is or may be presumed to be dabbed shut, now sunless and run, and the lakes now a lacking sum, undone in the total of this. Lack a stream. For much of the struggle, how the beginning and the air may be a match with the victor and its shills, until property owners still the historian, who has an epic as one angel in the lacustrine sediment and sand of southeastern Wisconsin, and for whom all others stare along an anywhere, oak-lined and sodden with creek beds, but who by no other words can now be defined formally as the subjects which are historical and tailored to the life work of the bluff and the single formation, the useless formation. How it's aged and high, these and others, as much as rock or as pinkish strata stripe the class struggle, south and down from oak savannas in the north to sand or gravel deposited southwestward. See how they act, and or as others act, on the oak forests and creek formations of the new calendar.
How there's present in width, from a state highway southwestern and inland, until it is reached by flowing ice, a haven member from the Holy Hill material.
How in red sediment and subsequently in oak forests and along the creeks by formations of sand and others, both forward and fine-grained.
How we are an average only, whereas the edge of the till is of massive origin.
How exposed in the state of geological surveys, some difference may be located in the sum total of this. Hexaity. This process of bottoming out of the here and now grows quickly sky-high by a conformism of now-sorted till in the ice and action of glacial divisions. Except the method of what's tilled out independently will instead be retraced, as it is host to a reality that can envision a further set of ore or minerals picked, which may vary from various clays to looks, a sum over histories and no mere historicism.
The kind young man with a shy smile, after Iona Harvey. Jen Ashburn. Women in America have much power, he says, driving his van carefully over the red clay roads of Laos. Women have much power, his uncle, who lives in Hawaii, told him. If a man hits his wife, the police will come. Women have power. The van driver whom I paid to drive these roads has a wife, a pregnant wife, and a four-year-old daughter. He is nice to me. All the men in Laos are nice to me. He drives carefully and talks about rice harvesting with his family. He waits patiently while I take photos and think, is this a man who hits his wife? He waits patiently while I take photos of Piawat Temple, which we Americans destroyed in 1968 except for a stubborn Buddha, a resilient statue charred black. I cannot ask about his wife. Why don't you marry? He asks over noodles. In Laos, you cannot live alone, he says. In Laos, family is everything. How to Catch a Baby Elephant, Jen Ashburn. You will need one jungle, one family of elephants with calf, 4 to 8 men, guns, spears. Pay off the local officials. enter the jungle like a prowl of cats. Circle the elephants at their favorite mud hole, where the calf will roll in the ochre water with a turtle-lipped smile, and his mother and aunties will brush with their trunks his face and chin in affection. Taking care not to harm the calf, shoot the mother. Shoot the aunties. Take the calf to a camp and enclose him in a cage slightly smaller than his body. Ignore his bleating warning cries. Begin training. Jab his young skin with spears. Do this while he is in his cage and he will think he is small and weak. If you are successful, he will believe this forever, like any animal, any child. If you are not successful, he will eventually break his chains, eat the crops of a nearby farm, and be shot. When this occurs, re-enter the jungle and capture another baby elephant. Here are their names. At the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, Washington, D.C. Jen Ashburn. It is a long, low line cut into the earth. And here is life. A squirrel pausing on a loping branch, earthworms behind the black marble pushing through clay, ants scavenging the turf. A grandmother talks to a little girl. She begins, "There was a terrible war," and then slides into Spanish. I understand mucha gente and los nombres and create the conversation in my head. Many people died. Here are the names. These men are not your great uncles or grandfathers. You were lucky. Yours made it back or didn't go. Yet see how many names? It was a terrible war. No, that is not what she says. Instead, I imagine she explains that all war is terrible, and this one was fought 9,000 miles away. And the girl's great uncle fought in it and made it back alive, but a lot of boys didn't, and here are their names. Or maybe the great uncle didn't make it back, and the grandmother says, "You have a great uncle, my brother, who died in that war." "Why did they fight?" the little girl asks, and the grandmother says, "No, this is still not right." It is a long, low line burning in our earth. It hurts. Yet the grass, the squirrels, the trees, the little girl.
A Cabin in the Woods by Tai Cronkite. I couldn't tell you whether I've been on this train for 5 hours or 5 days. The snow never melts, and the train never stops. Nobody speaks my language. This is about as remote as I'd like to get. Vodka? I understand that, and yes, please, thank you. Now would be fine. Later would be fine, too. "Look at the snow," I say, and a boy stares at me the way boys stare at foreigners. I'm deep into this, and I'm not getting out any time soon. Thousands of miles away from where I came, and thousands away from where I'm going. The boy stares. "Titanium dioxide," I say. "You know, white paint. Your country looks like it." I want to jump off this train, but the chilled vodka is warm in my stomach, and this boy is my friend. He talks to me into the night. Into the afternoon, I don't know. Night passes same as day here. I never know what is what. I can't understand what he says, and he knows it, but he likes to talk. I'm not sure if he's asking me about my life in America, or about my wife in America, or anything even close to that. I tell him I never had much luck with women, but that's all about to change. The train grinds to a halt. They've run out of money. That's the word here. It happens, I'm told. The train just stops, and when there's enough money, it starts again. When I complain, they charge me for more vodka. I buy a bottle, and I pass it around the compartment, and now there's a line at the toilet. I look at the picture of my new bride, as beautiful as any of the women on this train. 260,000 rubles, a little more than $1,200. That, and the cost of her passage. Could have booked a flight straight to Irkutsk, but I thought a train ride would be romantic. Give us some time to get to know each other on the way back, and save money, too. I close my eyes and imagine her waiting on the boarding platform, sitting on a suitcase that holds her life, waiting. I would have more money, too, if I wouldn't have kicked in the extra 60,000 rubles for the fertility guarantee. More vodka, and the boy's drivel is replaced by the attendant, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. She's been relieved of her position, indefinitely, or until the train starts moving again. She has family in Irkutsk, and a tattoo she's not afraid to show me. We have sex in the luggage car, and I think of my wife sitting on her suitcase. I return to my seat to take a nap. I try to sleep until the train starts moving again, but I can only manage about 45 minutes. The train doesn't move. My friend joins me again. She pretends I'm her rich American boyfriend, and I go along with it. I try to pay for something warm, but they don't have anything except chilled vodka, and they won't change my $10 bill because it's too old, 1995. For a moment, I think I'm happy with this Russian girl falling asleep on my shoulder. I lean back. Her head slides down my chest, onto my lap, and she dreams about titanium dioxide horses while I run my fingers through her oily hair. We wake up with frozen breath, bleary-eyed, still together. The compartment has emptied, and we see people waiting outside, some with luggage, some without. We walk on the rubber legs of sleep. The door is open, and the air is crisp. The snow along the length of the train has been trampled as attendants run back and forth, dragging Samsonite this way and that. They're not working for the Trans-Siberian Railroad any longer. They just need money to get home. 1,200 rubles for my clothes, and Lidka is happy to take my 1995 series $10 bill, but he doesn't have change. I wave him along, and he returns with the broken shell of the suitcase I got on the train with. Some of the clothes in it are mine, some are not. My friend, she stares at the white underwear, size 55, and I grin sheepishly, shrug my shoulders. She laughs, and I pause because it sounds like Rachmaninoff. Taxi cab. A distant voice and the faint rumblings of a small combustion engine over the rhythm of the train. Yes, I'll share the ride, and that means I'll pay as well, but I knew that. The car wasn't designed for this and can only make a few furtive movements toward us before digging out each time. 35 more miles, he says. Every 10 miles, he says, 35, and could you help me dig this out? It'll only take a minute. She has a certain style with throwing snow that renders me lazy and thoughtful. Our driver likes to drive, and he treats every curve with starved passion because they're so rare. He's disappointed when we get to the main highway, but he thinks of the dollars in his pocket and makes plans to change them. The speedometer wavers between 30 and 90. I twist my head to the blue sky and wonder how this place ever gets snow. He demands more money. My friend refuses categorically, and the hand in my pocket melts around a $20 bill. The commies really had no sense of aesthetics, I say. Well, then for the next 10 miles, our driver can only speak of football. Football! He fades back for a pass. The car drives itself. Yes, he says, and shakes his head violently as he plays air guitar. The car drives itself into a bank of snow. Rock and roll! Could you help me dig this car out? He hands my friend the shovel. Close to Irkutsk. I'm holding her hand like a prom date. What's your name? Wigger, she says, and I don't think that sounds Russian. Wigger? She shakes her head. No time to explain through the language barrier. She knows only phrases of arrival and departure. We stop in front of the station in Irkutsk. Our driver counts his money and shakes his head. I give him a 5, and he opens the trunk. I give him a 20, and he throws my suitcase on the ground. Rock and roll, he says, and drives away. Wigger touches me with her lips moist in the dry air, then walks me to the boarding platform and points me to my wife. She's certain of the one. Somehow she's right. I introduce myself. Thanks for the ride, Wigger says. My wife is like her picture, and to hold her is warm. Thanks for the ride, I say. My papers? Yes, of course. I pull a bundle from my coat pocket and hand it to my new bride. Is there some place to eat around here? I thought we could get something to eat and find a hotel for tonight. I catch a glimpse of Wigger still standing behind me, and I wonder what she's doing. Your wallet. What about my wallet? Give me your wallet. I pull out my Washington driver's license and hand it to her, thinking she wants identification. She grabs the wallet out of my hand instead. She opens her suitcase, and a life-size blow-up sex doll unfolds, then falls onto the floor. Your wife. I turn to look at Wigger, searching her face for an explanation. Happy honeymoon, she says in English, as she kicks me in the shin with a black steel-toed work boot. My wife shoves the metal suitcase into my face and follows Wigger across the crowded platform. I stand up, grab the naked doll, and run after them, but the doll is heavier than I imagined and difficult to carry. I get to the parking lot in time to watch my beautiful wife jump on the back of a Ducati right behind Wigger. They disappear behind a bus, and the sound of the noisy two-stroke fades away. The blue sky is gone, and snow is falling. I sit on the curb, look at the doll more closely. A tag tied to her wrist tells me her name is Babette, and she can fulfill my wildest fantasies. She's anatomically correct in every detail. Crafted in Switzerland by a reputable company dealing with the latest erotic therapies. Unlike her less expensive imitations, she's been constructed of a material similar in color and texture to real skin. Stuffed, not inflatable, as I first thought. She's put together very nicely, but hardly worth the $1,200 I paid for that bitch who stole my wallet. She has something written on her breasts in black permanent marker. You're all mountains. She's got a fucking map drawn on her with the roads and names of places and towns and lakes and rivers. Here's Irkutsk, right here, south of the Ural Mountains. But it should be north. I turn her upside down and I squint my eyes. There's a red line from Irkutsk, straight down Lake Baikal, to a location next to shore, about 40 miles past Babette's navel, and marked with a red X. Several people stare at Babette splayed out on the ticket counter. I need to get here. I point to the red X under her mound of fake pubic hair. How do I get here? The ticketing agent seems disturbed. She speaks very loudly and quickly, pointing to me like I'm some kind of freak. Some people in line behind me are staring. Listen, I'm not a head case. My wife gave me this, and it's got a map on it, see? She's a real joker, you know. Babette sits up on the counter, and everyone can see she's got a map drawn on her torso. They seem to understand that I'm not crazy, but the ticket agent is still in distress, and the manager is helping me now. Listen, just forget it, I say to the manager. Just point me to a copy machine. I'll show you, he says, happy to drag me away from anything he's responsible for. He takes me to an office with a few people sitting at small metal desks and points to a copy machine. I wrestle Babette onto the copy machine, close the lid on her back, and press the copy button. Nothing happens. I check her position and I slam the lid shut, which causes her to go into convulsions and say nasty things. I can't find a switch to turn this feature off, and the batteries are behind a plastic panel in the small of her back, held in place by four Phillips head screws. She falls onto the floor and stops convulsing, talking only when bumped. I'm informed by a security guard that the copy machine is not for public use, and anyway it's broken. He points to the power cord, unplugged and laying on the wooden floor. I pick up Babette, and she says, "Hey, big boy." The security guard motions to the doors in front of the building. Must be around midnight. The lights of Irkutsk bright in the distance, reflecting on the smooth white surface of the frozen lake. I'm standing by a well-worn track used by truckers heading up the lake towards Sosnovka and Kerbulik. In the winter months, the locals tell me, the trucks prefer driving straight up the lake to using roadways. I've seen two trucks pass in the clouds of blowing snow. This third one sounds like it might stop, the big diesel blowing black smoke as the driver shifts down through the gears. He says something in Russian I can't understand. I can feel the warmth inside the truck. I don't speak Russian. Where are you going? North. I climb into the cab, dragging Babette behind me. The driver is old and bent into his seat. He's wearing glasses with thick lenses and frames made out of baling wire. There's something weird about his eyes. Maybe it's just the glasses. Thanks for stopping. His hand finds the shifter and he grinds it into gear. The truck shudders violently as it starts to move again, and I can't get my door shut until he shows me the rubber cord that holds it in place. I try to stuff Babette onto the floor, but she doesn't want to bend the way I want her to. "Ooh, I like it rough," she says. I step on her head with my foot. "Give it to me, baby," she says. "Who's your friend?" the trucker asks me. "Her? She, well, my wife. I mean, the doll's not my wife. My wife gave me the doll. Look, there's a map. She gave me this doll with a map on it so I could find her later. She's real pretty." "Uh-huh. It's like an adventure. A honeymoon adventure. I need to find this place up the lake about 100 miles. He leans over to look at the doll, real close, so his nose is touching her. The truck veers to the left, but there's nothing to hit for at least a half mile, so I keep my mouth shut. "Babushka's cabin," he says. He puts the nose back on the windshield and corrects his course. He's got one bad eye, a wandering eye. I think I'm looking at him in the eye, and it ends up being the wrong one. The real one's watching the road, but I think he's half blind in that one because we keep losing the trail, so he starts driving in a huge S pattern from shore to shore until he finds the tracks again in the patchy fog. Old grandmother lived up there 20 years ago, froze to death trying to catch a fish one winter. Old trucker found her there, still has her fishing pole. Who lives there now? No one. Vacant. I can't see through the windshield anymore. The defrost clears a small hole in the driver's side window where he has rigged a second plexiglass window about 2 inches from the glass. Might be snowed in. Will be tomorrow for sure if it ain't already. Well, I gotta get there tonight. I feel like sleeping. I shift my weight, lay my head against the window. I am so wet, Babette says. Do you need a towel? The trucker asks me. No, thanks. She just talks. She says things like that. I'm getting used to it. Straight up through those trees, not too far. About 50 paces. I can't get you any closer. Right, thanks. I fall out the door. Babette follows me and the truck sends a column of black smoke into the air as it moves on. The frozen carcass of a chicken falls off the truck and lands in the snow a few feet away from us. I can see a faint, flickering light in the distance. The chicken under my arm is colder than the wind. There's a cabin in the clearing just ahead, 3 snowmobiles parked in front. I look for the Ducati and it makes me wonder about my sanity. Who would drive a motorcycle to a place like this? I feel good about thinking this. Insane people don't question themselves. They don't question their sanity. You drive me crazy, Babette says. The three snowmobilers seem friendly enough. They're dressed in wool and cotton fibers. I'm surprised when the short one swings a lead pipe at me. It doesn't hurt very much. I feel myself falling. I hear them tearing Babette. She thinks they like her. I see Russian currency swirling in the wind and snow. Laughter. The sound of three snowmobiles fading. And then silence. Babette is deflated, slumped in a distorted heap of erotic tatters on the wood-frame couch. The fire turns to embers. The wood is gone, and the snow covers the plexiglass windows. I lift her carefully to the floor and kick the arm of the couch. It creaks, and I can tell it'll give away with enough effort. I think about my wife, my money. My face is hot, blood is burning, and I want to scream. The couch splinters. Babette stares into the fire. You bitch. You whore. I throw this splintered wood into the fire. Worthless piece of cheap-ass rubber Swiss cheese. The wooden legs give with little effort and are placed on the fire with gentle rage. Flung. Cheesy $1,200 garbage. Don't look at me like that. Babette looks better stuffed and patched, but I wonder if it wouldn't have been better to destroy the table first. We stare blankly into the fire, and I feel romance. I put my arm around Babette, and I remember I forgot to call and report my credit card stolen.